This is Sam Swartz and Allison Markoski with your local news coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison.
Vice President Kamala Harris visited La Crosse today to discuss how the Biden administration is trying to support nursing home workers, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The visit comes as the Biden administration rolls out new rules for Medicare and Medicaid-funded nursing homes, increasing required staffing levels and setting aside certain amounts for worker wages. The administration hopes the new rules will reduce staff turnover and improve quality of care. It's Harris's third visit to the state this year as campaigning for the 2024 presidential election ramps up.
In celebration of Earth Day, Governor Tony Evers announced that the state is pledging to plant 100 million trees by the end of 2030. This is an increase from the 75 million trees that the state had previously pledged to plant. In 2021, the state signed on to the Trillion Trees Initiative, an effort to create healthy and resilient forests worldwide. Since then, the state has planted more than 32 million trees. As part of Forest Appreciation Week, the governor also emphasized his administration's work on conserving the Pelican River Forest and announced a grant program to promote urban forestry in the state.
Federal wildlife officials announced today that Lake Sturgeon would not be considered endangered or threatened, reports the Associated Press. The Center for Biological Diversity filed a petition in 2018 asking the United States Fish and Wildlife Service to consider protections for Lake Sturgeon, citing deteriorating habitats and overharvesting. Many states have outlawed Lake Sturgeon fishing due to population concerns, but Wisconsin still has hook and line and spear fishing seasons for sturgeon. More than 400 sturgeon were harvested in the most recent season this February. While the Fish and Wildlife Service acknowledged that sturgeon populations are nowhere near their historic levels, they pointed to dam removal and habitat restoration efforts, including the 2015 retrofit of a dam on the Menominee River, as reasons to believe the fish do not need additional protections.
A representative from a Madison Starbucks will be among the 150 unionized workers who will meet with the company next week to negotiate their first union contract. Starbucks has illegally refused to bargain with union representatives when it walked out of around 100 previous negotiating sessions, reports the Capital Times. But in February, the company and the union announced that it had agreed on a negotiating framework, with the process scheduled to start next week. The union negotiations could have long-reaching impacts on the service and restaurant industry, with about 10,000 unionized workers waiting for new contracts. Meanwhile, workers at the Starbucks on East Washington Avenue in Madison will be voting in a union election this Wednesday.
The developer LZ Ventures and the nonprofit Porchlight Incorporated have announced a partnership to build two new housing projects in Madison, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. First, LZ Ventures will build an 8-story structure on Madison's east side with 70 housing units for formerly unhoused people and space for Porchlight's offices. Porchlight is Dane County's largest provider of housing and services for the homeless, and the new site would move them closer to a day shelter, as well as other services and resources. As part of the deal, LZ Ventures would acquire Porchlight's current building on Brook Street, raise it, and construct a 15-story building there, with a focus on providing housing for university students. The two projects still need to be approved by the city, with the first project unlikely to begin until next year.
Madison's Common Council voted unanimously last week to change the requirements for accessory dwelling units, the technical term for buildings like in-law suites or garage apartments that are separate houses on lots with other buildings. The Common Council voted to allow these types of housing units on more properties, voting to remove the requirement that the owner live on the premises, as well as the requirement that the other building be a single-family dwelling, reports the Capital Times. A similar initiative last year to add accessory dwelling units as part of transit-oriented development met with significant pushback from homeowners who did not want duplexes in their neighborhoods. But last week's vote did not garner much public resistance, with only one public comment in opposition.
The University of Wisconsin-Madison's Education School announced that it is extending its Wisconsin Teacher Pledge following donations of approximately $8 million, reports the Capital Times. The pledge covers tuition and licensing costs for all teacher education students who commit to working in a Wisconsin school for 4 years after graduating the program. The goal of the pledge is to reduce teacher shortages and high rates of turnover in the state and has had nearly 800 students take the pledge since it began in 2020. The program is now funded through the 2028-2029 academic year.
Nick's Restaurant on State Street, one of Madison's oldest restaurants, will close in May, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Nick's, which has been in business for 65 years, has struggled since COVID, and according to its owners, has been looking for a buyer for its space since August of last year. Its last day will be May 11th. A Mexican restaurant is planning to take over the space, pending the transfer of a liquor license. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
An Illinois-based activist is renewing his call for federal legislation that holds police officers accountable after more than 5 years of inaction on the part of lawmakers. WORT news producer Faye Parks has the update.
It is unacceptable for police officers to shoot people unarmed. It's unacceptable for police officers to plant drugs on people. And it's also unacceptable when police officers see these actions that they don't hold other officers accountable.
That was Travis Washington, a social justice activist based in Illinois. He's also the author of the Hands Up Act, which he says would hold law enforcement accountable for misconduct on the job. He created a Change.org petition in 2018, which currently has almost 3 million signatures, including some notable names.
Michael Brown's mother signed a petition. Antoine Rose's mother signed a petition. Breonna Taylor's mother signed a petition. Jacob Blake's father signed the petition. Marcella Sennett's sister also supports the petition.
Over the last 6 years, Washington has reached out to more than 100 lawmakers across the country asking for their support. And according to Washington, while some have shown interest, none have pursued it seriously. So he decided to write the legislation himself.
So the Hands Up Act is a law where if a police officer shoots someone unarmed, they get a mandatory 15-year prison sentence.
Not only would the proposal regulate police officers who shoot unarmed citizens, but thanks to a new update, it also heavily penalizes those who falsify evidence.
Police officers who plant drugs on people will serve a mandatory 10-year prison sentence, or police officers who see police officers who plant, like, drugs, guns on people and don't report it will serve a mandatory 12-year prison sentence.
Washington says this last provision would be especially impactful.
There's this thing in higher education called mandatory reporter. I'm forcing officers to be mandatory reporters on dirty police officers.
The Hands Up Act has local support dating back to 2020, when Washington came to Madison on invitation from Impact Demand. According to the youth organization's leader, Ayomi Obuse, they reached out to Washington after seeing his TED Talk on the proposed legislation.
I think it's important for legislators to make sure that they're listening to their community. And we've seen how many signatures this petition has. We've seen the hard work Travis has done to advocate for this legislation. And so it's something that we need to enact as soon as possible.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
It's Earth Day, and Dane County Executive Joe Parisi took the opportunity to cement a legacy of environmental protection. He's set to retire this May after a decades-long career in local politics. On Friday, Parisi announced changes to some Dane County water quality programs, and on Monday, a new solar initiative. Reporter Jess Miller has the story.
Over the last few days, coinciding with his last Earth Day in office, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi announced several changes to Dane County's sustainability efforts. On Friday, Parisi visited a farm in Cottage Grove to discuss changes to some of Dane County's rural and urban water quality programs. The changes are intended both to encourage participation among farmers and local governments and maximize the program's impact on the county's land and lakes. And on Monday, Parisi announced that a landfill in Verona would be converted into a solar field. The first announcement Friday concerned the county's continuous cover program.
Basically, this is a program that provides grants and assistance to farmers who would like to convert some of their row crops into either rotational grazing crops, perennial grasses, or prairies. And they can choose based on their needs and their desires for how they're farming in the particular land that they're using. When we're doing traditional row cropping, especially if you're looking at land that might be kind of vulnerable to runoff, you get heavy rains and you can get runoff that goes into the streams that can contain sediment, phosphorus, and those streams empty into our lake system. And the phosphorus that's contained in that feeds the algae growth in our lakes. So when we can partner with our local farmers to turn that row cropping into either rotational grazing, perennial grasses, or prairie, when you can get that in plants that sink roots and they're there, you know, 365 days a year and there's no bare soil, then when it rains, that water stays on the ground and it's absorbed and it's not causing runoff, and we're reducing the amount of phosphorus and sediment that goes into our lakes.
Under the current program, which began in 2019, farmers sign a 15-year contract. To date, 133 contracts have been signed and 2,400 acres of land have been converted, about a third of each type of cover.
And because of the popularity of it, we've decided, in addition to this option of signing up for 15 years, that people can also choose to sign up in perpetuity and protect the land forever. Sometimes farmers like to get in for the first 15 years and see how it's going. Others might want to jump right in and protect lands in perpetuity.
Currently, the county pays $2,250 for each acre enrolled in a 15-year contract, along with the cost of seed to establish the cover. Now, the county will pay $4,500 for each acre enrolled in perpetuity, plus the cost of seed to establish the cover. Also on Friday, Parisi announced a change to the county's Urban Water Quality Grant Program, which was created to mitigate the impact of urban stormwater runoff into the county's rivers, streams, and lakes. As part of the original program, the county covered 50%, up to $500,000, of local government water quality projects.
Now we're upping the ante in that program also. We're going to pay up to 60% of a project up to $1 million. And all of these different programs and all these initiatives and partnerships add up to do what we need to do to address the many different sources of the challenges that our lakes face.
Since the program began in 2005, 10 municipalities have received funding for 73 projects, resulting in over 1 million pounds of sediment reduction per year. Finally, on Monday morning, Parisi announced that the county will be soliciting proposals to develop a solar energy site at the Verona landfill to power facilities on Verona's Badger Prairie campus and potentially provide energy for Dane County residents. The site has not operated as a landfill since 1986. Since 1995, the county has generated electricity from the methane the site emits, but expects these emissions will decline to unusable levels in the next several years. The landfill would become the 18th county facility to host solar.
And all together, when you add up all of these initiatives, all of our partnerships, we're making a difference.
For WORT News, I'm Jess Miller.
According to Dr. Paul Robbins, Dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, the threats to our climate often start on the local level. Continuing our Earth Day coverage, Dr. Robbins tells our news producer, Faye Parks, what individuals can do to fight for the natural world.
Thank you for joining me, Paul.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Earth Day has been around for decades now and has really changed folks' perspective on the natural world. Can you sort of walk us through that evolution?
Well, when Gaylord Nelson established Earth Day, he famously said that he didn't really have to do very much, that there was so much enthusiasm and interest in understanding what was going on in the natural world that all he had to do was announce the day. And so working with his staff, he did that, and teach-ins were already going on all over the country, including at the University of Wisconsin, but also the University of Michigan and elsewhere. So when it was formed, there was already a huge, huge interest in the environment, especially amongst students. You know, that was the genesis, and that's in the era of the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, and in the wake of the Wilderness Act and the founding of the EPA during the Nixon administration, actually. So the momentum at that time was federal effort and, you know, understanding of what we thought were the environmental problems of foul water, destroyed conservation lands, and lost species. And now, 50 years later, more than 50 years later, you know, global climate change, global biodiversity collapse, the problems have gotten bigger, but people's understanding of them is much, much better. So Earth Day has to change to both keep up with the enormity of the problem and the fact that there's actually a larger, more global constituency for the question than ever before. So it just has to be rethought.
So with this global constituency, there is also efforts on the local level. So what, in your opinion, are the three biggest threats to the natural world in southern Wisconsin?
So I don't think we can ignore climate change. We think of it as a global problem, but it's really not. It's a series of local problems, both the causes and the impacts. When we think of global climate change, for example, what that means in southern Wisconsin is buckets of rainfall. It is going to rain. And all the forecasts show and models show higher precipitation levels and more acute events. These extreme weather events are very likely to be coming our way. Heavy rainfall over 48-hour periods causing flooding, which is a huge problem. As well as temperature increases. So that at the local level means heat waves in big cities like Milwaukee or even Madison. But it also means just slightly warming stream temperatures, which wipe out habitat for really treasured species like trout. So climate change, big deal. That's day number one. The causes of global climate change are always local. They're local energy choices. They're how we put together our electricity grid. They're how we heat and cool our homes. All those things are actually not global problems. They're actually local problems of innovation and resources and justice. So everything that I describe as global is local. And the same thing is true of the second big challenge, which is biodiversity decline. That's an abstract word, I think. And what it really means is losing precious species we love. So as well as the ones we can't see, soil microbes or whatever else, but close to the heart and the home, one third of all bird life in the United States, in North America, Canada, and the U.S. has vanished since the time of the first Earth Day. One third of all birds are gone, which is unbelievable. So when Rachel Carson talked about a silent spring, that was what she was referring to, the idea that birdsong would fall silent in the world. She was talking about the problem of chemical treatments that we would use, and DDT was her big villain at the time, which is banned, fortunately. But that hasn't gone away. So as a problem, we have endangered species here in Wisconsin. We're deeply worried about the marten, for example, any number of species. So biodiversity decline, big environmental problem. And I think the third one is our water quality. Water quantity, as I said, is not a problem. We're going to have lots more water. If we're smart, in fact, we're going to be the lucky ones, unlike the Southwest, where I used to live in places like Tucson, Arizona. They're going to run out of water. We are going to have lots of water. The problem is it's loaded with plastics and lead and forever chemicals. And that's the third big one, is what's the quality of our water? I should say all three of these problems, because they're local as well as global, are totally solvable. They're solvable problems. I think that's what Earth Day is about, always has been. People going out and cleaning up trash seems trivial. It's not. It's a big deal that people are putting their backs to the land and thinking about how to restore it. So Earth Day is a reminder that we can put our hands on things and solve problems.
Absolutely. So you referenced cleaning up the ground of trash, that kind of thing. Are there other things that folks can do on the individual level to address what feels like sometimes a really overwhelming problem?
Certainly, there's a lot of things we can do outside of picking up trash. I mean, I don't want to trivialize those efforts. I think they're really, really good. But we could be thinking a lot about our energy budget. We could be advocating for the installation of renewables, putting them in ourselves, on our own homes. I am certainly not somebody who's done that, and it's totally doable. Being able to harvest your own water for use in your garden, off of your own rooftop, all totally simple things that you could be doing if you're thinking about questions of water, you're thinking about questions of energy, and anything from pollinator gardens to managing your property in slightly creative ways actually addresses the biodiversity crisis. How do we deal with the fact that monarch butterflies, the toughest of all species, these are animals that migrate from Michoacán, Mexico to Canada. It's a miracle, right? It's an amazing outcome of evolution. All you have to do is make sure that we maintain the landscapes and the habitats that they treasure, need, and depend on, and you're actually contributing, you know, to maintaining a global population. So people can do all kinds of things on their own property and their own communities. And then, you know, they can also be advocates at the regional scale for sensible developments. People should be more active with their public service commission, thinking about what the energy grid looks like. That isn't about federal policy. We always think about the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. There's all kinds of decisions that are made at the county level, the regional level, the Wisconsin level, which are practical questions about people's energy bills. And those are things people can do in their day-to-day lives. So engagement with regional and local policy, property management, and working with their neighbors to maintain landscapes around them, all very meaningful. These are going to have big impacts, and you multiply them over a large population, which we have, and you have solutions.
So before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think the last thing I'd say is that the one thing I think people have woken up to since 1970 is how big the potential constituency for the Earth is. I think historically, there's been a somewhat narrow range of people who thought of themselves as being concerned about the environment. They called themselves environmentalists. I think we're way past that. I think you don't have to be an environmentalist to be engaged in your heating and cooling, worried about the clean water that comes through your pipes in Flint, Michigan, but also Madison, Wisconsin. That there's a greater diversity of needs and a greater diversity of constituencies. And they don't have to be, frankly, left-leaning, middle-class people, which is historically what the environmental movement is. They really can be a diverse population of conservative farmers, people who are not engaged in other kinds of politics, lots of people of color involved in questions about the environment that they live in and also about the greater outdoors. There's just like lots more people who should and are involved in the environment. And you ignore those people at terrific peril. And if we think about environmentalism as the only solution to environmental problems, we're doomed. I think is bigger than environmentalism. That is the key lesson of Earth Day 50 some odd years later.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Paul.
My pleasure. I hope that was useful.
That was Dr. Paul Robbins, Dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news here on WORT. I'm your host, Allison Markoski, here with my co-host, Sam Swartz. Thanks for joining us.
Every year, Madison's Park Division hosts the Earth Day Challenge, inviting volunteers to help clean up almost 50 parks around the city. In this archival edition of Desire Lines, feature contributor Carrie Ann Welsh heads to James Madison and Tenney Park to speak with some folks making the city's green space cleaner for everyone.
This is Desire Lines Radio. I'm Carrie Ann Welsh.
Winnie Severson.
Dick Severson.
We certainly need to take care of the Earth. Big time.
Last weekend was the annual Earth Day Challenge at Madison Parks. I went out to talk to some of the volunteers about trash, the weather, and those grabber tools.
I'm Peter. We live over near the park on Gorham Street. And this is
Danny.
And have we done this before, Danny?
Yes.
Well, we wanted to come today because Danny's been learning about Earth Day in class. So we wanted to pick up some trash. I'm the pastor at St. John's Lutheran Church, so we try to get out occasionally in the community and do something fun and positive for the neighborhood. And we also, since we live here, we use the park a fair bit. So wanted to keep it looking nice and clean.
My name is Mark Williamson, and we're here as part of St. John's Lutheran Church cleanup.
It's Marcia Williamson. Our church is part of this neighborhood. It's 322 East Wash, so it's important to us. We always want to be good neighbors. So.
Well, you know, we're both lifelong residents of Madison, and we like to clean up the neighborhood.
Oh. We did it at Olin Park one year. It was beastly. It was snow flurries.
It was blowing snow.
Yeah.
It is gorgeous out today. I mean, the weather's like warm, but not too warm, which is great for this kind of work, for sure.
My name is Alex Einsman. Well, I live right across the street from the park, so I have a very close relationship with this beautiful place. And I'm with the Friends of James Madison Park. It's a group that recently just started to help care for the park and maybe do some fundraising for different improvements and stuff like that. Today, we are a bunch of volunteers are picking up garbage. And we're over here spreading mulch around the basketball court area in the berm. So sweating just a little bit, making it, but it's fun. It's a pleasure to be able to volunteer for this park. It's such a beautiful space for our community. I work just a couple blocks up, so I'm definitely walking through here twice a day and usually find some time to kind of just hang out and look out at the lake.
I'm Alice and my husband Dan.
Hi.
I am here because it's first day. I've been doing this for 50, 60 years. I don't know, however long. I remember 1970, I was a senior in high school, and it was like one of the few times our band went out and marched. And it was for Earth Day. And we marched around the neighborhood of the school, and it was kind of a big to-do. And so since then, it's kind of been important to me.
I can just tell you I've appreciated Wart being there forever. I mean, the jazz that you guys play is just excellent.
Ashley Jennings.
Ryan Jennings.
Mrs. Owen.
Hi.
So it's been nice to use this park a ton. I feel like he thinks it's an extension of our own backyard, so it's nice to keep it clean.
I'm Patty Prime.
I'm Serena Jardal.
We're picking up trash at Tenney Park.
Yeah, to celebrate Earth Day. My grandma invited me, so uh-huh. Just here to help out.
But we did find a icky
underwear or something in the water. Yeah. No, but yeah, mostly it's just stuff that we can't really see unless you kind of are looking for it, I feel like.
I volunteered several years ago, and you didn't have to look. I mean, it was all around, especially along Johnson Street and in the trees. And yeah, so today we were like, wow, it's just pretty clean, I have to say, which is great.
Maybe in the last couple of years, people have become more environmentally conscious just in general and hopefully are cleaning up after themselves in the park.
I remember the first Earth Day. It was very unusual for the time. They actually did not have any regular programming that day at school, and we just did all activities around, you know, ecology and why it was important and things like that. So very memorable.
Every day is Earth Day.
Every day is Earth Day. There you go.
My name is Dave. Basically going around all these edges of the lagoon and pulling stuff out, finding people's picnic debris, a lot of plastic lids, which kind of explains why we can't ever find Tupperware lids at home. That's where they go.
My name is Brooke Libke, and we're a team here from Children's Wisconsin. We had a committee through Children's, our African American Inclusion Resource Group, that wanted to put together some community efforts, and this is one of the community efforts we chose to do. So we got a team together and came out on this beautiful day to clean up the park.
Diana Rhodes.
And Nancy Cobb.
I am tired of seeing trash everywhere, and I saw this advertisement, so I said to my cousin, do you want to do this with me? I'd like, you know, have somebody go with me.
It's been a lot cleaner than we expected, which is really nice. It's mostly around the waterways that we're finding stuff and bottles and so forth in the water. That, thankfully, I brought my my gripper that my dad left behind when he died, and I'm making use of it, so I don't have to actually handle the stuff.
Yeah. Mostly like alcohol bottles, plastic things. Pieces of paper.
Lids off of, you know, fast food, drinks, things like that.
But not a lot, though, overall. I'm quite impressed. Yeah. Happy to be out on Earth Day and celebrate our Wisconsinite that created this wonderful thing.
I'm Paige. I'm picking up trash for Earth Day at Tenney Park. I live nearby, so it was really close, and I come to this park a lot, so I like keeping it clean. And it's already actually surprisingly clean, but it's a fun way to get outside and maybe get sunburned for the first time this year. Even though I call this a small amount, it's still like a garbage bag full, and like that's just me picking up garbage. And I don't know, if everyone did a little bit more other than just picking up on Earth Day, it wouldn't have to be like this. And everyone's really happy to see us out here, so I know people like the idea of doing it.
What is this thing called, this tool?
Ooh, a grabber, I think, or like a picker. Everyone calls it something different. I think I'm gonna get one for myself though. See, every park has a different style, so I'm testing them out by going to these, and I'll get my favorite one on Amazon this week, I think. I like the bits on the end here, they're rubber, so they actually grab stuff like cigarettes. Otherwise, other pickers I've had where they're just like blunt edges like this, they don't pick up as nicely. I really wanted to pick up garbage, but I feel kind of weird picking it up by myself, or I did at first, so I thought I could make friends that way, you know, especially after graduating college. But now I'm more comfortable doing it by myself since I've done it a few times, and like I said, everyone's always really happy to see you. Like, everyone smiles at me, so it's cute. I don't know.
For WORT News, this is Carrie Ann Welsh.
Since 1979, Labor Notes and the Troublemakers Union has brought grassroots labor activists together to exchange organizing notes, tactics, success stories, and lessons learned. The 2024 Labor Notes Conference is just wrapping up in Chicago and featured presentations from activists in the United Auto Workers, the Writers Guild, and many others. On this morning's 8 o'clock buzz, host Brian Standing spoke to two Madison area labor activists who attended the Chicago conference.
First up is Joanna Frasch, at-large executive board member for AFSCME Local 1. Welcome, Joanna.
Hi, Brian.
And also with us is Barbara Smith, a member of AFT 48. Welcome, Barbara. So, Joanna, let's start with you. What was the thing that impressed you most about the Labor Notes Conference? Was there a particular lesson that you took away from this?
Yeah, I did take as a whole back, I think, all three of us from Local One who attended, that we can affect change, like no matter how small we are able to do a lot of big things together. So I was really inspired by that.
Was there a particular speaker or a group of people that impressed you?
I took a lot of media classes, and those were very helpful to me. Of course, one of the things we learned was community radio is the best thing to help us get our message out. So, of course, we know that about WORT. Also, to just get out there and start spreading our vision for Local One, which for state employees is a vision of support. We want to be there to support them. And also of hope. We have hope that we can make state employment better together for future time.
Barbara Smith, let's turn to you. I mean, a lot of the focus of this particular conference dealt with folks from around the world. What do you feel about the internationalization of unions? What can we learn from folks in other countries?
In past labor notes, I've realized that the rail industry is heavily passenger-oriented in a lot of countries, and they have a lot better service, you know. This time I went to some climate workshops. That's certainly an international issue. And we did have some of those Italian delegates in the session on expanding Medicare for All to all people in the United States. Anyone who's here living or visiting, we want single-payer health care. So they were there to share their experience of what they have and how they're fighting cuts. And so, you know, we have a common enemy and a common fight.
One of the other major features of the session included Sean Fain from the United Auto Workers. They recently celebrated a victory in Tennessee with the Volkswagen plant, one of the first to organize in the South. Joanna, what did you hear from UAW in parts of the country that are traditionally difficult to unionize?
Yeah, absolutely. I was able to attend a workshop that had one of the social media organizers for the UAWD, which is the Democratic Caucus, and they were responsible for really running the campaign that elected Sean Fain. And he had a lot of good insight to get just regular rank-and-file members involved on social media and keep the conversation going and bring attention to issues. My sibling was at the party in the evening when the Volkswagen announcement came through, and he said it was really just exciting. It's just amazing to be in that moment.
First off, tell us a little bit about the state of AFSCME Local One. Local One obviously is called Local One because it was the first union local formed as part of the AFSCME union. What is the status of organizing for state workers right now?
Well, currently, Brian, we're learning from some folks that they think that they can't join the union, and we want to make it clear to them that we are here. It is not in any way illegal for you to join AFSCME or WETEC, where Barb represents. We're actually, you know, looking forward to connecting with more of our state coworkers so we can hear issues that they're facing. At this time, we're really hearing a lot of struggles around staffing, which is causing burnout. So we want to be there to support them and hopefully work through some ideas that we can put forth together to help remedy these situations.
You've got an event coming up to help bring people into Local One. Tell us about that.
We sure do. And it's actually, Barb will be there as well with us. So it's together with AFSCME Local One and AFT 4848. And we are just holding a meet and greet, kind of a casual listening session at the Madison Central Library. And that will be on Tuesday, April 30th at 5:30 p.m. in room 104. So the main library right off the square.
Barbara, tell us a little bit more about some of the types of sessions that you attended at the Labor Notes conference. What did you find particularly useful and what did you learn from your colleagues in other places?
I went to one workshop on what's sometimes called pre-majority unions, so unions very much like us in the state employees, unions that have not yet had an NLRB election, don't have a contract. Amazing ideas, you know. There's actually a number of groups that have really gotten some great gains. University of Tennessee workers, for example. I think Texas State employees, also Alphabet, the Google employees union, is a pre-majority union. So that was very useful.
And
there actually were a number of sessions on Palestine because that's such a hot issue now. Some AFSCME folks had a special button on that, supporting the Palestinians. So I went to one on veterans, you know, veterans hospitals, which is, it's even better than Medicare for All because it's an actual public facility, one of the best. And so we're trying to improve the VA.
So you were talking about pre-majority unions. What were some of the tactics or strategies that you learned from some of those groups? How can you affect change when you're not negotiating for a contract?
Well, collective action and concerted activity, which is actually legally protected to act as a group. Petitions, I know in Tennessee, they staved off a very major privatization effort. The governor wanted to take all custodians and all facilities repair people, which would have been 20% of the whole state university workforce, and privatize them. And they pushed back successfully over a period of time using, you know, media campaigns, petitions, just the whole gamut of things. Partnerships between students and workers on campuses, that was one thing they did. Just a whole range of things. I'd have to look back, but I want to study more because some of these groups have been particularly militant because they've never had a contract. And they have won a lot of things. They won pay increases for a lot of the categories of workers at University of Tennessee. And they even have, you know, foreign workers because they have a lot of graduate students. So, you know, there's special laws about that. And some of them think they can't ever get involved. And that's not true.
Joanna, tell us, what are some of the things you learned, some specific tactics or strategies you learned at this conference that you're going to take back to Local One?
Like Barbara, I did really identify with a lot of the unions in the South that are organizing and pouring tactics to affect change without having collective bargaining. Some things that I know that we can do is, you know, do surveys, find out what is most important for us to address for state workers. And that's also part of, you know, the idea of having the meet and greet so we can talk to them and hear them on issues. And then we can formulate a plan, which might include petitions. It might include visiting members of our legislature. It might include, in some cases, you know, doing like almost I learned how to do a virtual run on the bus. So it might be some creative things that we can do to make changes and to help employees be empowered in their current situation. Because right now we're hearing from a lot of our state coworkers that management is not listening to them. And we know that, you know, the conditions of our state workers directly affect the quality of services that the people of Wisconsin are receiving. And we want to make sure that we can help them improve their working conditions so that improvement goes out to the public.
All right. We've been speaking with Joanna Frasch of AFSCME Local 1 and Barbara Smith of AFT 4848. For more information on the recently completed Labor Notes Conference, go to labornotes.org.
This week on Madison Mixology, reporter Charlie Bielowski has all the details on one of his favorite cocktails, the Tequila Sunrise. From its origins in the 30s to its reinterpretation in the 70s, and how it soared in popularity with the help of two famous bands.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to Madison Mixology. I'm your host and favorite reporter, Charlie Bielowski. Today we're heading to Sausalito, California to learn about one of my favorite drinks, and how a wildly famous band had a hand in its popularity to this day. It's time to learn about the Tequila Sunrise. Now, to say that the Tequila Sunrise was conceived in California isn't entirely true. The original drink was crafted by a man named Gene Sullett at the Arizona Baltimore Hotel in the mid-1930s. It was crafted using a mixture of tequila, cream de cassis, lime juice, and soda water. This version wasn't too popular, however, and the drink didn't see much traction until the 1970s, when it was modernized and simplified to tequila, orange juice, and grenadine. Around the early 1970s in Sausalito, California, a pair of guys named Bobby Lozoff and Billy Rice, who worked at the Trident Bar, which is still around today, by the way, decided to change up the way that the Tequila Sunrise was made. They wanted something more simple and appealing, and eventually swapped the cream de cassis and lime juice for orange juice. A splash of grenadine later, and the drink quickly received notoriety. Soon after the drink was made, Bill Graham, a famous rock concert promoter, hosted a party at the Trident to kick off the Rolling Stones' 1972 tour in America. It's unclear if it was Mick Jagger or Keith Richards who promoted the drink first, but the band liked it so much they began to drink it and request it at every stop they made across the United States. They even dubbed their tour the Cocaine and Tequila Sunrise Tour. The drink, now associated with the Rolling Stones, skyrocketed in popularity and led to a demand for it throughout the country. Before long, it topped the menus of swim-up bars and began crossing borders to places such as Tijuana and the Caribbean. A year later, Jose Cuervo hopped aboard the hype train and began publishing recipes for the Tequila Sunrise on the backs of their bottles. And in the same year, the Eagles released a song called Tequila Sunrise on their Desperado album. Adding to this was Robert Towne's film of the same name, starring Mel Gibson, Kurt Russell, and Michelle Pfeiffer, which was nominated for an Academy Award. Making this drink is a cinch. A simple mix, starting with your trusty glass and ice. A highball glass is recommended, but any and all have been used here. From there, add in 2 ounces of any Blanco tequila. Today with me, I have Jose Cuervo. After that, add a little over 4 ounces of orange juice. And finish off with about a quarter to a half ounce of grenadine, depending on how much you like cherry. The drink should take on a beautiful chromatic hue, and from there, it's ready for consumption. Bottoms up! It's very sweet, crisp, and orangey. Now, usually, the way I make my Tequila Sunrises is I actually add some Malibu to it and I swap out the OJ for mango puree. That's just kind of the way that I like to get it done. It adds more of a coconutty flavor and it tastes very good. But the drink on its own, like the original blend using the Jose Cuervo, the orange juice, and the grenadine mixed together is still very tropical, very reminiscent of beaches and other, you know, relaxing outdoor activities. Definitely something that can take the edge off really well. And I can see why the Rolling Stones took so fondly to it. Very good. Last year, on June 25th, the Marin History Museum actually placed a historical marker at the Trident to commemorate the Rolling Stones party and the reinterpretation of the Tequila Sunrise. As I stated before, one of my favorite changes that I make to this drink is usually swapping the tequila for Malibu rum or mixing Malibu rum and tequila into the drink. It gives it a tropical coconutty blend to the mix, and I'm a huge fan of it. The closest cousin to these drinks, however, would probably be the Queen Mary, which uses beer instead of any sort of other, like, sharper spirit, more hefty alcohol by volume spirit, and there's a float of grenadine over the top of it. It's the only thing that comes relatively close to any other sort of sunrise beverage that was made. Try any of these drinks and maybe even throw on some Rolling Stones vinyl to really complete the 70s vibe. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Charlie Bielowski, and thanks again for listening to another segment of Madison Mixology.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Nate Carlin. Jess Miller was your reporter. Special thanks to feature contributors Carrie Ann Welsh, Brian Standing, and Charlie Bielowski. Victor Calzoni engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Shally Pittman is the news director here at WORT. I'm your host, Allison Markoski.
And I'm your host, Sam Swartz. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcasts. You can subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial, The Access Hour. Have a great night.